This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 21st of May 2014 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Grundig. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Coming up today, we're in New York for Design Week. We've been pounding the pavement citywide to bring you the best of NYC by design. In today's show, we've braved the elements to discover some of the most interesting one-off events.
This is American walnut, so I've only used Irish walnut before, and it's similar, but it's a bit more stringy. Yeah, it's a nice smell off it, and it looks lovely.
We've taken shelter in some of the most exciting satellite exhibitions.
We've got Beck Britton, Grain Design in Seattle, Iacolia McAllister, Scout Regalia from Los Angeles, all these young design studios that we're really excited about.
And we've taken the temperature of American design with the great and the good of the industry's leading figures here.
I mean, I think right now it wouldn't be a stretch to say that Brooklyn is really the creative center of New York. And that's not just in design, that's in a lot of different things.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, in New York on Monocle 24. Nestled snugly in the design calendar between Salone del Mobile in Milan and Design Miami in Basel, Design Week in New York, or NYC by Design, as it's officially known, has long struggled to make its voice heard on the global stage. This year's event, though, running from the 9th of May until the 20th, has packed a real punch, and myself and the team have been in town surveying the best of what the US has to offer. One of the most interesting one-off events during Design Week took place in the garden of the new Standard Hotel in the East Village. The wind and the rain that we braved was rather appropriate, given the provenance of the company who was showing there. Makers and Brothers is an online venture set up by brothers Jonathan and Mark Legg, dedicated to showcasing, selling, and supporting the best of Irish craft, and some more besides. In New York, they made a mock-up of the tin shed they work from at their base close to Dublin. And here they presented a range of pieces, including ceramics by Derek Wilson, glassware by Gerpoint, and woodwork by James Carroll. James was also on site, braving the elements with his tools, whittling a set of wooden spoons in a makeshift workshop space.
This is a walnut from upstate New York we got, and I'm working at green, which means it's not been seasoned, so it's much easier to split and carve and shape because it's got moisture in it. So what I'm using is a fro to split it with. It's a bit like a long, thin axe, and a maul to hit the fro with to split the wood. I'm going to split it now. Well, this is American walnut, so I've only used Irish walnut before, and it's similar, but it's a bit more stringy. Yeah, it's a nice smell off it, and it looks lovely. It's a simple, basic knife that you use, and a hook knife and an axe. So they're very simple tools, but they could take a whole lifetime to try and master. But you learn a lot all the time as you do it, and it's quite nice because it's almost the ideal object. You're constantly turning it around in your hand, and you're considering all the... You're seeing a 3D image all the time as you rotate it, so you're making design decisions all the time. And there's so much design goes into a really nice spoon that it's deceptively simple when you see it. So it's a bit of an unusual thing to do in downtown Manhattan, using an axe and stuff, you know, in a constructive way. It's nice engaging with people passing, you know, that's great.
So how long have you been doing this for?
I've been working with wood for about 20 odd years. I've just been getting into carving spoons over the last year or so.
Yeah.
And it's probably certainly another 50 years of learning anyway. And there's lots of growing interest in it because it's something people can do for themselves. And something we use every day as a spoon, so why not it be a wooden spoon you made yourself?
Yeah.
The walnut smells nice already. I use I finish it with a knife, so I wouldn't use sandpaper to finish it, but it gives a nice hard finish and makes it kind of user-friendly. It doesn't absorb the cooking stuff. This is a hook knife you use for taking out the bowl of the spoon.
So how's the reaction been with people on the street, sort of walking past and seeing?
A lot of them have been confused But it's nice when people make the effort to engage with it a bit, and yeah. People really do. They might still be confused at the end, but at least they've hopefully learned something. People respond really well to it. It's a real basic kind of a thing that they can see what's happening right in front of them, and everyone relates to a spoon, I suppose.
Why did you choose the wooden spoon to sort of show off your skills and to bring here? What was it about?
It's just sort of a perfectly contained thing to do. It's obviously mobile and simple. It's also, as with being simple, it's quite it's difficult. Yeah. And people can relate to it. That's probably the best thing.
As James continued to work his wood, I took shelter with Makers and Brothers creative director, Jonathan Legg, about setting up shop in New York.
Makers and Brothers is an online venture I started with my brother 2.5 years ago. And I guess it was kind of a reaction to the way we felt Irish design was being represented, and we wanted to find another way to do it and make it more relevant to a global audience. And that's why we set it up. And we also believe that there was a lot of interesting work out there with raw, genuine qualities to bring value to everyday life and, yeah, enhance people's surroundings. If your home is full of products that have those qualities, like where you understand the provenance, you appreciate how it's been made, they have that tactility that brings a warmth to the environment, then they're the type of products we wanted to show people and share with people.
And why bring it to New York? Why is it a great showcase for you to be involved in?
We have a load of customers over here.
Is it the Irish connection or?
No, I don't think it is. No, because most of them actually don't have that Irish thing going on, though a lot of Americans do. Earlier today, there was quite a few of those in. I guess they've read about us and heard about it and they've bought off us, but the nature of what we sell, you can't pick up on it at all in a picture. Like, you need to hold it and touch it and smell it and feel it.
Yeah.
So we kind of have a commitment to doing 3 or 4 pop-ups a year. I guess we enjoy the theatre of it as much as anything else.
It is a nice spectacle here, isn't it?
It's quite fun building a shed in a garden in the middle of Manhattan and having James here with his axe. Yeah, there's a nice story to that.
One of the what I find interesting, although it's all to do with kind of really amazing craft, it's not really an exercise in nostalgia, is it? I mean, these are very sort of... Do you carefully tread that line?
Or? Yeah, and that, I guess the creation of Makers and Brothers would have been a reaction to much of Irish craft was quite nostalgic. Mm. And I guess we felt there was a space to make it modern and relevant.
And as the rain began to clear with all the luck of the Irish, James Carroll's wooden spoon finally took shape.
I've let this dry just over quite a short time because it's quite thin. It dries out quickly. Then I can finish it with a knife, and it will give a better finish once it's dried out a bit. And I use the knife to finish it because it actually it slices through the cells better. I don't ever sand the spoons, it gives a much nicer finish. It feels nicer and it wears much better. And you can finish it in a couple of different things. You can use linseed oil or walnut oil or different oils that are going to stop it from absorbing too much of the cooking juices and stuff like that. And it'll change colour a little bit from depending on what you use it for, and we'll give it some more additional patina. That's kind of quite a nice thing, I think.
That was James Carroll talking to me there, along with Makers and Brothers creative director Jonathan Legg at their pop-up shop at the Standard Hotel in the East Village. You're listening to our NYC by Design Section D special. I'm Tom Morris. Although Trade Fair ICFF remains the beating heart of Design Week here in New York, it's in the many smaller offshoot fairs where you detect the real pulse of design happening across the nation. Sight Unseen Offsite has been undoubtedly one of the strongest. Set up by Monica Kermsuroff and Jill Singer, the show is the love child of the girls' website, Sight Unseen, and NoHo Design District, another satellite exhibition which the girls ran for 3 consecutive years during Design Week. At its gargantuan space in Soho, Sight Unseen Offsite hosted a series of young emerging studios, including Ladies and Gentlemen, Bauer, and Rosie Lee. I caught up with co-founder Jill at the show.
We started what was called the NoHo Design District in 2010. And it was actually only a few months after we started Sight Unseen, the website itself. And the reason we started the NoHo Design District was we'd gone to all these other fairs in cities like Milan and London and Stockholm, and there just seemed to be a feel there that was a little bit more neighborhoody, a little bit more indicative of the character of the actual design in that city. And we felt like those things were a little bit lacking in New York Design Week. There was also kind of an evolution at that time where there used to be a lot of things happening in Brooklyn, and the Brooklyn scene was kind of dispersing a little bit, and that seemed to no longer be happening. So we really just wanted to create something fun, some place where emerging designers could show their work, especially those who couldn't necessarily afford to show at the Javits Center, which is where the main hub is, and a place where we could have the same kind of curatorial vision that we have on the website. So we started in NoHo. It was kind of a conglomeration of design exhibitions and then working with retail stores in the area like the Future Perfect and Partners in Spade, and it became kind of this festival. But that was always on a bit of a smaller scale than what we have this year. So this year, the real estate had become a little bit too difficult to find in NoHo, so we made the decision to become nomadic. So from now on, we'll go wherever the great space is. But we landed upon this amazing, almost 20,000 square foot in the middle space in the middle of SoHo. And people had kind of been encouraging us for a while to rebrand it as something with Sight Unseen in the name, so people understood more the connection between the journalism side and the curatorial side. So it became Sight Unseen Offsite. With this much space, we kind of felt free to go crazy a little bit. And we ended up with about 50 exhibitors, which represents more than 100 designers. Mostly, like maybe 80% from America, but there's also designers from Sweden, from Berlin, from St. Petersburg, Florida. It's a good mix.
And who are some of your favorites in the show at the moment? Who do you think some of the standout people involved?
For a few years now, we've been touting Ladies and Gentlemen Studio from Seattle. They are just one of the most exciting studios in just terms of the material experiments they do, and everything has this real simplicity. There's a lot of very basic geometric shapes and materials like untreated wood and copper and brass, and they just become something so special in their hands. They collaborated this year with a Seattle-based glassblower named John Hogan, and the combination of the two is really, really exciting, like beautiful mint-colored glass with their kind of geometric mixed media take. So that one's really exciting to us. I'm also really interested in this small studio in Brooklyn called Bauer. They've only been around for maybe a year and a half, and they've produced so much work so quickly. It's all so beautiful and well-resolved. They have this piece here that's mirrors that are like also very geometric and also kind of mixed materials because they're kind of regular mirror and shaded, different hued mirrors. And they're really, really beautiful. I think they're kind of like one of the next big things. Kind of on the bigger side, Kelly Bahune's studio is with us this year. She's an interior designer in New York, and she's only recently started making furniture. And she takes all these classic Bauhaus-inspired, maybe Memphis-inspired forms, and she does this great digital laminate. So she had done like black and white stripes and primary color kind of things before. And this year, or for this edition, in addition to that, she went to Morocco, made all these beautiful kind of rag rug type things, and then digitally printed images of the rugs on the furniture, which is an incredible effect. And then Monica and I also collaborated with this brand, Print All Over Me, which is kind of a really high-end cafe press where you can upload your pattern or graphic that you designed and get really nice sweatshirts, bomber jackets, printed in all-over pattern. So we chose some of our favorite illustrators and paired them both with the clothing items and with our favorite furniture designers. So we have Fort Standard, we have Eric Trine, we have a Seattle-based designer named Eric Ginder, and we paired them all with illustrators to create these amazing geometric all-over patterned furniture things. So it's quite beautiful.
I mean, you must have done the whole sort of circuit of design weeks and things. What do you think makes New York different?
I think part of the nice thing about New York Design Week, especially in the last few years, is how it isn't just about New York. That's kind of the exciting thing to me, is the New York design scene means something to people all over the world, and we are this incredibly like grassroots, community-minded group. We all help each other out, and that's been really exciting. But it's also really nice that all these design talents from other cities in America really fit into that kind of same aesthetic. You know, you have Jonah Takagi in DC, and you have this amazing scene in Seattle like Iacolia McAllister, and you have this amazing scene in Chicago and Los Angeles, and that all comes together for New York Design Week. And they all kind of have like a bit of a different aesthetic, and I think that's what makes New York Design, or at least Sight Unseen Offsite, so interesting, is like you have all these different viewpoints, even though people are kind of working with a lot of the same ideas and concepts, it does have a bit of a geographic tint to it.
That was Jill Singer, co-founder of Sight Unseen Offsite, speaking to me there. You're listening to Section D. After this short break, we'll be heading to the main event of ICFF to speak to one of the leading American exhibitors there.
For over six decades, Grundig has made people's lives better and simpler. To this day, we bring our expert knowledge of design and technology to a wide range of high-quality domestic appliances. Whether refrigerator or radio, oven or audio system, we continue to integrate our manufacturing heritage with state-of-the-art technology. Grundig synthesizes the best of yesterday with the best of tomorrow, expertly and innovatively designed for you and your home. Grundig, supreme engineering, timeless design.
You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, and this week we're in the Big Apple for a New York Design Special. Of course, no trip to the design season here in New York is complete without a stop at ICFF, the long-established commercial centre of the event. This year's exhibition trod a very careful line, hosting the global big boys, including Artek, Tom Dixon and Fritz Hansen, right next to smaller design studios and startups. One of our favourites at the show was Emeco, the American brand most famous for its aluminium, or aluminum, 1006 chair. They presented two new collaborations this year, one with Philippe Stark and one with Japanese design studio Nendo. Emeco's Vice President of Product, Magnus Breitling, was on hand at the fair to talk me through the process of bringing these two new projects to market.
This year we are launching the broom, bar stool and the whole Sue collection. Additionally, we have also some seat pads, recycled PET and wool. So this is the emphasis in this show. And our traditional products, our heritage products, are also shown at DWR. But here on the stand at ICFF, we really want to put the emphasis on the new collections.
So you're working with Philippe Stark and Nendo, two huge designers. How did those sort of collaborations come about?
Two different approaches. Nendo was approaching us with the Sue collection, and basically a designer as a vision. We haven't been quite happy with the beginning, but it turned out to be a very nice relationship, and we call that playing ping pong in between the company and the designer. The designer has a vision, we have an idea about the product, and then we try to make the best out of it. Before, the chair was not quite looking as it does right now, because otherwise it would be just another other chair. But this definitely carries the Emeco heritage with the typical seat shape, translated into a new design, into a whole collection, actually.
When you're working on products, how do you collaborate with a designer but also still keep the DNA of Emeco present in that kind of partnership?
You know, Emeco is a very authentic company. We are trying to be as honest as possible and keep our heritage alive. We cannot just make another chair, and everybody wants another chair, but is that really what we want? No. What we want to be is, we want to be honest and true to the products we are doing. Now, you just asked me before, working with a designer is always like manifold. It's different. With Philippe Stark, it's different because he's a good friend of the CEO and president, Greg Buchbinder. They're very good friends, and there's always a dialogue keeping alive. And after launching the Broom One, we are limited because this chair is stackable, it's perfect for cafes, but when you have a cafe, you want to sit in different levels, on different heights with the bar and counter. So there was the idea to translate the Emeco not just into a counter and bar height, but also involve the collection. And so basically this chair came alive. The Nendo project was going on a different way. So it's really manifold. I cannot really describe it. It's like how it comes together. It's like you need to sniff each other and work it out somehow.
Talk me through some of the materials used. Let's start with the stool by Philippe Stark.
Philippe Stark's stool is basically the same what we did also with the Broom collection one chair or standard height. It's basically the same material. It's 90% waste material. It's reclaimed polypropylene mixed with sawdust. And of course there's for strength a little bit glass fiber in there and also some colorant. Additionally, what we did in this chair is quite significant, because when you do this chair, and we wanted to do it like a pure monoblock chair so that it's not like it's only one piece. When you do this framework underneath, the footrest and the slabs on the side, the material needs to flow a specific path. And we figured out to have only one knit line, and it's created here in the front. And the aluminum, therefore, is not just the footrest in order to prohibit the plastic of scraping, but it's also translate the forces when a really heavy person stands there to translate the forces out of here. So it's very stiff and very strong. It's an ideal chair.
How long does it take to sort of research that and develop these kind of products using these sorts of particular materials?
It was taking quite some time. You know, I need to start a little bit earlier. When we did the 10 or the 111 chair together with BASF and with Coca-Cola, this chair, PET, reacts completely different in high temperatures. So we needed to develop an extra material, extra colorant, and it's shut in a very, very high temperature. Now we wanted to work with this chair a little bit easier, so we choose polypropylene. Now we put wood in there. Now we do it at a very low temperature. So it's always like going the borderline between having superior material and engineering possibilities. But we worked here with an excellent partner and made this chair.
I want to talk about this eco-concrete that Nendo's used on the stool over here.
Yeah. So basically this concrete, not just that it contains 50% of glass, so it's really recycled glass. So you crush it, you grind it up, and it's 50% glass in there. And the concrete, you know, I need to speak mathematically. So basically, when you produce concrete, concrete is a not eco-friendly material to begin with. We are trying to be as eco-friendly as possible. So this concrete, what is used here, is not heated to 1,500 degrees Celsius, only to 1,250 degrees. So when you look at the heat curve, when you heat some material, for the last 250 degrees, you have the same carbon footprint you have for the first 1,200 degrees. So basically, it's like an E times X function going up. So you save that. So this material is basically 4 to 6 times more eco-friendly than regular Portland cement.
That was Emeco's Vice President of Product, Magnus Breitling, talking to me at ICFF there. This is Section D with me, Tom Morris, in New York. For the second edition of French Design Connection, held during New York's Design Week, design journalist Anne-France Bertillon and editor of Monitor magazine, Anna Udina, co-curated an exhibition in the lobby of Manhattan's Chambers Hotel. Rather than selecting works solely from French designers, the duo focused attention on what they call the French attitude, a paradox between being both sensual and rational, making a selection of pieces from Mexico to Sweden. The carefully designed space displays 15 modern works on the two-floor lobby. Anne-France took Monocle's Megan Billings on a tour of the exhibition to chat about some of her favourite pieces.
Francesco Pirello was the organizer who organized last year the first edition of French Design Connection in New York, and he's curating different, organizing different exhibitions under the Meet My Project label. Contacted me because I used to co-curate an exhibition on Norwegian design in Paris 3 years ago. He had been in touch with some Norwegian designers, and it started like, you know, like everything in life has it. But the point is that last year was the edition in New York was called French Design Connection. So we inherit the name, and that was in fact not a burden but a very good starting point. So I co-curated the exhibition with Anna Udina, who's the editor of Monitor magazine, and I'm a freelancer and working for different architectural lifestyle magazine design. So we inherit the French Design Connection, and it was very clear for us that Anna being born not in Russia, Francesco being Italian, me being the only French, that we didn't want to be struck into the nationality. And because it's something a little bit too narrow for the wide world. So we decided to take the best of what French could be and sort of brainstorm. And it came to the idea that what could be so French is being paradoxical. It's being both sensual and rational. And yes, everyone is speaking, you know, from a health perspective of the French paradox. Let's see how if we could translate that into design. So we scanned the design scene on an international basis and tried to pick up pieces that were giving some elements of answer to that paradox. So one of the pieces we have in the exhibition that embodies probably ideally that concept is the obsessive compulsive disorder table by Erasway Studio in Mexico. So they're Mexican, they're not French. But you know that French are so keen on having everyone putting everything in a case, and you can't be one thing and just the opposite, which we all are. So this table is like an organization of different trays, some of them being rectangular, a lot of geometric. It's very organized and it's very splitted at the same time. And we thought that could be, or it could be a flat brain. It was a good introduction.
Let's talk about some of your favorite pieces that are here.
There are, that's always difficult to have some favorite pieces, but just to give some light, maybe, and mirror the concept, this is the mirror called Mitro by Carol Gay. So Carol is a designer from Sao Paulo. She used to do some workshop with the Campana brothers, but she's part of that generation, which is a little bit post-Campana, because we're trying to scout what's happening now, not looking back at the past, which could be a French feature. Anyway, so this is a mirror made of, like a fan, you know, it echoes the soul French Versailles Galerie des Glaces and all that idea of looking yourself in the mirror, and it's part of metallic and part of meter. And we have here the paradox of you can look yourself into the mirror, say, well, I'm not looking bad. And then you have the meters that reminds you maybe that, I don't know, we're in May, that's summer times, and if you want to go to the beach this summer, and there's also, because the mirror is hanged by a measurement tape. So we liked it very much.
Okay, let's walk over to another one.
So this other piece is from Lit Lit Lundin. This is a series. So Lit Lit Lundin is a collective of Swedish designers. And what we really found is interesting is that they're not even living in Stockholm. And now that it's important in the design scene that technology allows you to be in any place of the world and not only on this big design hubs and capitals that were supposed to have all the designers together. You can, you know, I don't know, Remy Hayon is living outside Valence in a small village. So you can, technology allows you to be closer to nature, and they're really interested into nature because all the material that is wood and leather is sourced from around 50 kilometers around their studio. This is the Locavor translated into design. And the series of stools and a small table are interesting. They are based on the tensimetry principle. So lots of very thin legs of wood or leather, and everything is flat back because this is what's the beautiful of the thing. It's not IKEA, but you can do something flat back which is not IKEA, and that means that you can be in a small village in the middle of Sweden, produce your beautiful design and send them all over the world being flat back, and could be an Hermes tool, to be honest. So.
And where do you see the connection with French design here?
We saw the connection because it has something very luxury and Hermes for us on that. And also that idea of having, you know, very simple products, that ingénieur, all that Arzimitié, you know, the Eiffel Tower, all that tradition of French designers, French engineers, that nowadays I'm probably working all over the world. We have also selected pieces, these vases from, this is not only vases, because every object has a function, but what's interesting here is that there are multiple functions, from Pia Wurstenberg for Utopia and Utility. The name of her label itself was echoing so perfectly our central and rational statement. And Pia is part Finnish and part German. She lives in London. She studied at Royal College of Art. And so she's international by essence. And in each of her pieces, you can have different places. You can see, scan the world, because all the glass section is made in a Czech Republic, because their knowledge and their craft of glass blowing is fantastic. And then the base, depending on the materials, whether it's copper or ceramics, is made in the UK or in Germany. And the last part on wood is made in Finland. So this is like, this is the connection. This is designed because everything is functional. It's not only a decorative piece because it's a ball, it's two balls in one. It's, you know, like the tupper. It's very, very rational, but it's fantastically sensual because of the colors, because of the combination of material.
That was Anne-France Bertillon, co-curator of the French Design Connection, talking to our very own Megan Billings there. Taking place not much longer than a month after, NYC by Design is the time when many of the pieces launched at Milan Furniture Fair are brought over and presented to the US market. At the Soho showroom of Italian manufacturer Cassina, Spanish designer Jaime Jeon was in town to show his Vico sofa, which was first shown during Salone. It's the first time he's worked with the brand, and I sat down with him to discuss this new relationship with Cassina, plus how New York shapes up in comparison to the design fair extraordinaire in Milan.
The project started basically because we started to have conversation about, you know, the type of design I was doing and with the directors at Cassina, and they were pretty interested about my style, the work I was achieving. And they said, well, we'd love to have a Cassina piece from you that has your style, but it also reaches well our expertise, so what we are able to do. So I said, well, I'll try to make something. I thought about it like a soft piece. I mean, I didn't really have a brief or anything like that. It was like more an approach of, okay, let's make sort of a piece that could go around the living area. And that's how it started. So that's how we started the piece. It was like just starting the geometry, then started to think about the definition of the volume. And little by little, we made some models and the thing started to be a reality.
What happens when they sort of approach you? Do they sort of say, okay, we're looking for a chair to add to the collection, or a table, or is it completely sort of carte blanche for what you want to do and what you spy missing in their range?
I think there's a little bit of both. I mean, I'm someone that I really have a hard time to work on a brief. I mean, you know, there's something that comes into my mind which is coming before any sort of brief. And, you know, for example, in this chair for me, it was the sensation of making it float. I said, I want to make a comfortable sofa, but it has to float. I don't want a big structure. I don't want it squarish. It has to float really nicely. So the minimum it's hold, the better, you know? So it was very, very intentional to keep it really floaty. Actually, I did even a big cut in the part of behind, you know, to make it even float more. It looks like I cut the ass, you know, of the sofa, you know, to just, you know, make it even floating. And there was a relationship in between the triangles of the piece and the triangles of the volume. There was this idea of geometry, you know, and this idea of comfort. So for me, you know, to have a brief and to tell me, hey, do whatever you want, it doesn't really work like that. I mean, I could have come by and just said, listen, Cassina, why don't you do a green chicken rocking chair? But they would say, no, I think. So I thought about, you know, maybe I can make a piece of design that is comfortable, that it fits, that it can have some of their colors, that it could have some of my colors and some of the textiles I like. And this is how we're doing it. You know, now, right now we've got the first pieces and then there's other ones coming up. So that's how it is.
What I love about it is a chair that sort of looks good from every angle, doesn't it? It's a, you sort of turn it around and, I mean, the back is very good looking. The sides are very good looking.
Yeah, I do actually think a lot about that because like mainly, especially the sofas, generally they're not very much designed from behind at all, which is a shame because I think we don't live in these kind of situations today in which like everybody puts their sofas just near the walls. And, like we live in lofts and we live in spaces that are much more open, you know. So I think I like the idea of like designing it from every corner. For me, the most beautiful is the side because you can understand really well every single detail I've been working on in terms of stitching, in terms of details. You know, something quite amazing of this piece is that, you know, like in a square shape, it's very easy to take the textile out and wash it. But in a piece like that, it's a hell of a job. And in this piece, you can take it, you can zip it out and just wash it. So it's like a haute couture dress. You know, the guys were challenged like hell and they looked at me going like, okay, so how are we gonna do this? Because this is like, it's rounded that way, it's rounded this way, it's rounded from the front, from the back, it's then straight. You gotta think like Alaya, you know, like you said, you have to think like, okay, how do I dress this to be undressed then after because it's not glue. 99%, I would say almost, of the upholstery organic forms in the market, you know, they're glue because there's no other way to reach the form. But this one is not glue at all because they want it to be really ecological. They're Italians on this thing. It's very complex. And I tell you, that's what it makes them unique. Then also, we reach this really, really thin layer of, it's really thin when you look at it from the front, but it has a lot of comfort. Because it uses also this old classic Italian way of upholstering, which has springs in it. You know, so we mixed a little bit of technology with old school Italian way of manufacturing, and that's what it makes it interesting.
That was Jaime Jeon talking to me at the Cassina showroom in Soho. You're listening to our NYC by Design special here on Section D with me, Tom Morris. After the break, we're heading to the bright lights of Midtown to discover the best of Made in America lighting at Roland Hill.
Grundig believes that televisions should provide more than entertainment. They should connect you with your world. its state-of-the-art smart LED TVs allow you to unite with friends via Skype, watch over a sleeping child next door with baby cam, or control access to the internet through your mobile phone. Grundig is committed to investing in the best technology, digital innovation, and superlative design to help you bond with the world from your own home. Grundig, supreme engineering, timeless design.
You're listening to a special edition of Section D from New York. I'm Tom Morris. Brooklyn-based lighting manufacturer Roland Hill was founded by designer Jason Miller in 2010. In just a few years, the brand has made its name for working with some of the most exciting luminaries of the lighting design scene across the United States, including Beck Britton, Lindsay Edelman, and Rich Brilliant Willing. All the pieces they produce are hand-assembled in Brooklyn. But back up in Midtown, founder Jason Miller walked me through the new collection at Roland Hill's pop-up showroom on Fifth Avenue.
We're presenting five new product lines. So we have one by Philippe Melwin, Paul Loback, myself, and then two by Beck Britton. In addition, we're showing some new variations on existing products and some big spectacular things in the front.
And you put together a sort of amazing installation here. How do you sort of plan ahead and kind of think, curate the designers that you're working with, the pieces that you want to show, and where you put them all? Is it months in the planning to create something like this?
I would love to say it was, but it was much less time, actually, because this show really comes on the heels of the Milan show. We have about a month to plan for it in reality, but that's enough time. This year, we really made an effort to focus on new products and not to just, you know, try to show the whole collection, but to really show the stuff that was new. And we also worked with the firm Snarkitecture to do the exhibition design.
And you always do sort of big bang at Euroluce in Milan. What's the difference between showing on home turf to showing in Europe?
On some levels, nothing really. We spend a big part of the year creating new work, and any opportunity to show it is great. You know, so in that regard, it's not too different. But that said, you know, New York is our home, and we feel a certain, I guess, responsibility here that we don't in Europe. It's like a family holiday as opposed to, going out with your friends. There's something more intimate about it for us.
And you are sort of a real champion of Brooklyn design. I mean, some of the best things I've seen here particularly is bead lighting, and it all kind of seems to be Brooklyn-based. How do you sort of describe what's going on at the moment there?
I mean, I think right now it wouldn't be a stretch to say that Brooklyn is really the creative center of New York. And that's not just in design, that's in a lot of different things. And that movement's been happening for, I would say, 10 to 15 years. And it's primarily based on small makers. And we're really benefiting from that culture. We are a part of it. That's how we started. That's how I started my design studio and how I turned that into Roland Hill. You know, many of our designers work in the same way. So we are, you know, benefiting from it and promoting it at the same time.
I think the quality, it sort of is now on a par with sort of the great big Italian lighting companies. Would you say that sort of, you know, Brooklyn design has kind of grown up?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there is a real energy happening right now in the design world in New York, specifically in lighting. And in a way, it's like the perfect storm. It's becoming greater and greater. You know, there are a lot of really wonderful people out there that are working. Lindsay Edelman, Beck Britton, you know, Paul Loback. There are other companies out there that are doing good work as well. And we all know each other. We're all friends with each other. And there's, I think, a good degree of healthy competition as well. You know, and we're pushing each other to do better and to do more interesting work.
When you're sort of creating a show like this, how often do you add new designers to the roster? Are you out there gathering new finds all the time? Or are you sort of quite happy with the family that you're working with?
Well, we work with about 10 designers right now. And what I really try to do as a creative director is go find designers that I truly believe in and let them do the work that they want to do. So what I'm interested in doing is bringing designers in and doing many projects with them, rather than trying to go out and get a project here or a project there, you know, from individual designers. So when I bring someone into Roland Hill, the goal is to get them to really work very closely with us and, you know, to allow them to produce a body of work as opposed to just a light or two.
That was Roland Hill's founder, Jason Miller, talking to me there. When Scott Fellows and Craig Bassam, the founder of Bassam Fellows, were appointed by Herman Miller as creative directors in 2010, it signaled a good moment for American design. Herman Miller is the manufacturer of countless American design classics, most notably the portfolio of Charles and Ray Eames. And it seemed fitting for the company to collaborate with arguably one of the most significant American furniture studios of today. Over the weekend, Connecticut-based Scott and Craig, an Aussie by birth, were at the Standard Hotel presenting new pieces for the Herman Miller collection. I sat down with them on their new bolster sofa to discuss this meeting of two American greats.
We had a very strong concept going into it, and how we work is we draw very detailed drawings, and so there's no napkin sketches going on. It's a very detailed set of drawings. We had a great prototyping team, and so we had worked out a lot of the aesthetic details going into it, and obviously the proportions and things, and so we could go straight to a working prototype. So we managed to have a very quick turnaround and quick run to get to the final product. So it was actually everything went very smooth, which doesn't always happen, but it went very smoothly this time, so we're very happy.
Do you prefer doing it that way? Or is it nicer to sort of have months and months and months and months to sort of really refine things?
Well, if you start off with a concept and you know what you want to do, actually, I'm really keen to see it finished. I don't want it to be drawn out. Once you've started the process, one thing I don't like, actually, is if things do get drawn out. I don't like a long process. I like the fact that you can concentrate and just work on it until it's done and everybody is involved and has the time to do it and you can concentrate on it. I think when you're in it, you're in it. I don't want to be sort of sidetracked with too many other things. So in this case, we were able to really concentrate on this project and see it through quite quickly.
And Scott, I was interested sort of how, you know, doing something for Herman Miller, sort of one of the great American companies, and showing it in New York. What's that like? Is there a pressure or home talent on home turf?
Yeah, I think that just working on collection in general it's an incredible honor to be working with some of the greatest icons of modern design of all time. And so that's, you know, it's a big responsibility. I think that in our role as creative directors of Herman Miller, we take that responsibility very seriously. And because the pieces are serious, we're very serious about any kind of material changes or reissues that we do. We're always working hand in hand with the Eames Foundation or the Nelson Foundation or the Noguchi Foundation in order to make all of these classic reissues happen. And so I think that when you're doing new product, it's very important that the new product fits in with the existing classics. And so that is a big responsibility, and it's a great honor to be asked to do that and to be sort of sensitive to that. And we take that very seriously, and it's something that is also really fun and inspiring.
That was Craig Bassam of Bassam Fellows talking to me at Herman Miller's presentation at the Standard Hotel in New York's Meatpacking District. We're in New York for a Section D special. I'm Tom Morris. Norway has historically been overshadowed by its other Nordic neighbours in the design world. However, in New York, it became evident that Norwegians are determined to change that. Besides flying over a number of Norwegian designers, there was a comprehensive selection of events to promote what Norway has been up to recently. And as we're talking about the richest Nordic country, with a fair amount of oil money to be spent, we may well see the results of this new marketing push very soon. Monocle's Marcus Hippie popped by Nordic Design Night at New York's high-end co-working space Neue Haus. He first spoke to Andreas Val Berman, who's been working as director of the Foundation for Design and Architecture in Norway. Andreas had an explanation for why Norwegian design is still relatively unknown.
What has happened now is that Norway has recognized the importance of design, which is a long-term work, which has happened, been going on for 50 years. But what we see now is that the same is happening in Norway. That Norway and Norwegians recognize their own heritage and their own designs and manage to promote it in a better way.
Who are you thanking for the fact that Norwegians are appreciating and recognizing their own design nowadays?
That must be the designers and their quality of work. It's been the same quality of work over the last decennium again, but what we are able to do now is that, to be honest, the fact is that for a designer in Norway to actually have enough to do, you have to get abroad. Because we're a very small country and we need to get it out. So the designers also promote and are becoming much more better to promote their own work They don't take no for an answer from either the producers or anyone else. So they are the strongest voice in promoting Norwegian design.
And talking about Norway, I could imagine you have a fair bit of resources to use when you are pushing Norwegian design abroad. What exactly are we talking about over here? What is happening and what is your plan and what are your goals?
The goals are to promote and show design as an important tool for development, as an important tool for industry and market mechanisms. And in Norway also we now recognize this as an important factor in Norwegian produce and in Norwegian industry. So you could say that we're sitting here now as a result of that, where the Norwegian consulate of the General Consulate of Norway in New York City recognize and has been for many years recognized Norwegian design as an important tool to show what Norway can show and what they can make.
Norwegian Design Night exhibited works by young designers along with some older classics. One of the innovations drawing attention at the exhibition were small plates or bowls that change the way you perceive whatever it is you are eating. This is how designer herself, Runa Klok, explained the idea.
These are tasting shells, that's what we like to call them. I designed them with Marte Freista, and also we're cooperating with some famous chefs in Norway. And they're small bowls that you can eat directly from, and it all started with us going to restaurants, and we discovered that no matter how beautiful it's presented, the food, you always eat with a knife and fork. And we wanted to create a new way of eating. So we were inspired by the way you eat oysters. We wanted to have like a closeness to the food, so you would actually hold the food, and the food is in the bowl. It's very small, and it's shaped to fit inside the hand. It's a small snack you would eat from this one. Then we were thinking about, could we also do something else? Could we alter the way things taste by the way it's served? And that's why you see it's three different shapes. So one is very narrow, and one is quite open, and one is more dividing the food. So when you eat directly from it, the food would hit different places on the tongue and enhance different flavors. Actually, it works.
So what's the difference when you taste something? If you've got the most narrowest version compared to the widest one, what's the difference?
Well, the narrow one, you would have to close your mouth around it, and it would hit the tip of your tongue, and it would enhance the sweetness. And the more open one is the more balanced, because it would hit the whole tongue. And this one, where you divide the food, it would go on the side of the tongue. And it's like when you bite a lemon, you feel really on the sides of your tongue. So that's how it would feel, or when you eat from this one.
Finland has Moomins and Denmark Legos. Who knows, we may all soon be equally aware of Norwegian wooden birds. Designer Lars Bella Fjetland.
What do you see? A family of five birds, wooden birds, made from reclaimed wood. They're cute, a bit dorky.
I'm wondering what the background story for these birds is. How did it all begin, and where did you get the idea of designing these kind of things?
It started with me actually gathering a lot of woods from dumpsters, building sites, and from different workshops around the city, trying to figure out a way of making something new out of something that was unwanted. And I thought that I perhaps could combine this with learning how to master, wood turning. So I just want to start with a very simple shape, the bird body. Once I mastered that, I thought about, adding features, like feathers, adding a chest, perhaps a beak. And slowly I advanced, in my turning skills. I thought about, perhaps I should do a couple of different species, trying to sort of figure out what are the main features, trying to figure out their character and their personality, the kiwi bird being a bit dorky, curious, there was a lot of trials. I think I've done probably 50 birds just figuring out how they were supposed to look. So after creating them, I thought, okay, that was a nice project, but I never imagined that it could turn into a commercial product.
Lars wasn't the only designer in New York full of excitement about Norway's new design push. So watch out, Finland and Denmark. Norway is coming in full force. For Monocle in New York, I am Markus Hippe.
And that brings us to the end of this week's NYC by Design special edition of Section D. Today's show is produced by Ala John and edited by Holly Fisher. And special thanks to Markus Hippe and Megan Billings for all their help. You can contact Aled at awj@monocle.com if you've got any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris. And to play you out, while we're on the subject of great things to come out of New York, here's the Yeah Yeah Yeahs with Turn In 2. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.